Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you. Hello. Today on Historically Thinking, my guest is Mark Carnes. He's the professor of history at Barnard College and Columbia University, and a formidable expert on 19th century American history. And we might touch on that in a bit. But he's become best known as the originator and the champion of a pedagogical method known as reacting to the past. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Al, thank you so much for having me. Delighted to be on your show.
Before we get to reacting to the past, your book, Minds on Fire, How Role Immersion Games Transform College, is an apologia for reacting to the past. It is a very sophisticated, and I say this in the best sense of the word, a marketing presentation for reacting to the past. It's a memoir of how you came to this. It's also a survey of how professors teach and how students do or do not learn. It's a lot of things. It's a fascinating book. I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in the least in history or teaching or even higher or higher education. But let's talk briefly about how students learn. How often do students study?
Well, their study after study comes out. I mean, in the past decade, there have been a drumbeat, intensifying drumbeat of studies that say that students don't study very much, and they don't work very hard. Now, obviously not all students, but if you look at the studies, the results are very disconcerting. Students don't work very hard, and students who don't work very hard don't learn very much. That isn't my opinion. That is the judgment of the significant weight of research on this subject.
Yeah, this is not anecdotal stuff from disgruntled professors, of which one hears a lot. This is a really a meta study, a macro study of many studies would indicate this.
It's not too just that we're talking about students at community colleges and two-year schools. Even students at elite schools often will do what's necessary to get an A, but they won't immerse themselves in the subject. They won't take a deep interest in the subject. They'll do what's necessary for their grade, but the life of the mind will elude them. Mm-hmm. It's easy to say this is a problem of two-year schools or regional state universities, mm-hmm. but the problem of student disengagement really is throughout the gamut of higher education, or so I believe, and so many observers believe as well.
Yeah, the Academically Adrift, written in 2011, also I think showed to everyone's satisfaction that about 1/3 of all students don't improve in the actual reading and writing skills over the over their undergraduate career. I didn't say 4 years because we don't. Sometimes it usually takes longer than that.
Well, and of course, then there's the crippling data, which is that something like 45% of entering students don't graduate at all.
Yeah, and I haven't mined that data, but I would be we often associate that with the two-year institutions, regional state institutions, but I suspect that happens. I'm seeing that happen at my liberal arts college more often than I would think.
Well, you know, one of the points is that people say, well, how can students nowadays be expected to graduate, particularly if they with a tuition costs being what they are, and they have you have older students who may have families, you have people who are working full-time jobs, and so the reason why people aren't graduating is that they're simply overwhelmed by jobs and by life pressures and the cost of higher education. But there is an interesting study, a very important study by Bill Bowen and a group of other researchers who looked at the financial background for nearly a million students during a five-year period at, I think it was 21 state universities, tier one state universities. And what it found out was, yes, if you are from a poor or minority background, you're much less likely to graduate than students from well-to-do backgrounds, but that a third of the students from the highest socioeconomic categories failed to graduate.
Yeah.
So this exactly makes your point. It's not just poor, overstressed students who aren't graduating, but also well-to-do students aren't graduating, or at least a lot of them aren't graduating. It has nothing to do, in their case, with money. It has something to do that they're bored with school.
Yeah, and we'll link to that study in the notes for the show.
It's called Crossing the Finish Line.
Yeah, and I highly recommend that anyone who's thinking of sending someone to college should read that as a sort of consumer due diligence.
Well, the study's interesting because the headlines were that poor students are much less likely to graduate, which is true.
Yes.
But the other headline is that the biggest problem with graduation retention isn't financial. The authors couldn't figure out, what do we say, though, if finances aren't the big problem? Why are well-to-do students not graduating?
Yeah.
And that's just, what can you say to that? That they said, well, there's a lack of motivation or interest, but what can colleges do about that? And that's exactly what my book, what the Reacting Pedagogy is trying to address.
Well, of course, we'll get to that. We'll lay a marker down on that turn in the conversation, come back to it. Unfortunately, professors usually blame students. Increasingly, state legislatures, federal bureaucrats, and parents blame professors. Let's professors first. They blame the students. How? How long have they done this, by the way?
Well, I'm an historian, ultimately, and so I always look for the roots of problems. So if it's true that lots of students are deeply disengaged with the academic enterprise, how long has that been true? And if you look back at the accounts of college teachers, it looks like students have always been deeply disengaged. I cite the example of Henry Adams back when he was at Harvard in the early 1850s, and he said nobody took the classes at Harvard seriously. When he then is brought back to Harvard as a professor, as part of the Charles Eliot's transformation of Harvard University in the 1870s, he teaches, trying to inspire the students as he was not inspired, and he concludes there is, after 7 years of experimentation, there is no inducement, these were his words, that a teacher can use to stimulate the interest of the students, that 90% of his students, 9 students out of 10, were simply hopeless. And so you hear these accounts forever that students have been deeply disengaged. So professors like Henry Adams and our colleagues today, we say the problem is not with what we're doing. In fact, if you look at the front row, the students who've got their hands up, who are in class every day, who are just hanging around afterwards, we say the problem is we don't have enough of those students in the front row.
Mm-hmm. If only
our institution would admit more of them, we'd be just fine.
Yeah.
But, of course, the problem is that Henry Adams was himself one of the slackers when he was an undergraduate. A lot of the slackers end up being only slackers in the classroom. They do, Bill Gates would be just one of countless examples of people who are really very, very clever, very creative, very motivated, but are losers in the classroom. So the question is it the student or is it the classroom experience? And my argument is that often the classroom experience is itself a not very effective learning environment, and learning research over 40 or 50 years has shown that our lectures and our loosely structured discussions are not very effective learning vehicles.
One professorial attempt, earnest professorial attempt for decades, centuries, has been to improve the content of that being taught. So in my time period, we have Thomas Jefferson says, as governor of Virginia, gosh, I'll fix up the curriculum at William & Mary and people will pay attention. He does that again at UVA. People are always trying to improve the curriculum, the content, and thinking that this will capture students' attention. And this is part of the whole approach to general education reform. Doesn't that work? I mean, doesn't that work for some
time? Al, you're absolutely right that for two centuries, when faculty have discussed education reform, they've shuffled the curricular deck. They will say this subject should be taught more than that subject. And this leads to all sorts of political and financial wars within institutions.
Yeah. We could have the most
and epic... it confuses faculty who assume that pedagogical reform is about what we teach.
Yeah.
And so we end up teaching the same ways that Henry Adams was teaching in the 1870s with slightly different emphases on the content. And the worst part of this is that faculty assume that the discussion of educational reform is all about content, what courses should be required, what things should be in the general education mix, and it diverts attention from the pedagogical structures that we've had forever and that don't work very well.
This debate, well, all great university fights are always over curricular changes. I think I can almost say that without almost exception. But it's gotten more intense since the introduction of the research university into American higher education because of the specialized nature of the research university versus the general education curricular reform that we see brought in by people like Erskine at Columbia. Don't you think?
Well, that's absolutely true. And over the years, research is synonymous with specialization. If you're going to make a contribution to knowledge, you have to focus on ever narrower topics and fields, which means that what we teach as research scholars is smaller and smaller and smaller and less connected to the large issues that stimulate liberal arts engagement, that stimulate students to say what this knowledge is really matters. So the research paradigm, which makes perfect sense for generating advances in knowledge, tends to undercut the significance and the heft of the learning experience for students who are at such institutions, whose faculty are attuned to the narrow specialization that they need to advance knowledge, and whose students are looking for issues of enduring importance and heft.
How does that work at Bernard? You're a specialist. You're a specialist in 19th century American history, and yet here you are talking about Socratic learning and Socrates and all the rest of it with great familiarity, I assume, because you've had to teach him in the core curriculum.
I guess this is a bit of a segue, but I am
curious about how there aren't many places left where specialists are forced to go outside their discipline. I would suspect that yours is one of a few.
Well, I Well, I mean, the only way I got tenure was at Columbia University, which meant that I had to assimilate to the research standards of Columbia University. Sure. Barnard is a part of that, but I guess the point was that in my case, that after I got tenure and as I began to go deeper and deeper into the burrow of my field of specialization, I saw that process as also somewhat scary, that I was becoming more and more of a scholarly specialist, that the issues were more increasingly technical and small, and I was a little bit nervous about that. Mm-hmm. So in a way, having been granted tenure, that gave me the scope to look at some larger issues, and uh-huh. but also to give a thought to what I was teaching my students. Uh-huh. And I began to perceive, here I was, a tenured scholar at a major institution, chair of my department. I had my accomplished a lot of career goals, yet uh-huh. in the classroom, my students were bored, I was bored, and I couldn't figure out why.
So you were being pushed to a critical moment, and we could talk about Socrates and the Olynkus in a little bit. You're being pushed to a critical moment at whether you either submit or you build up an armored resistance and move on.
Well, there's a little bit of arrogance too, in that I figured, well, I've fulfilled my career goals.
Yeah.
I know the subject matter, having taught it for 10 years. I didn't, you know, like most beginning professors, I didn't really have the command of the material that I should have.
Right.
But at this point, I knew the material. I was at a top-notch school with excellent students, and I was teaching the big texts, the classics of the human imagination. I had it all.
Yeah.
A good teacher who knew his stuff, excellent students, and superb material, and we were all bored.
Yeah, and they,
so that was so. How can that be?
Yeah, yeah. So what happened?
Well, after doing one class, this first year seminar on these materials with these good students, and I was I couldn't figure out why the class had failed to catch fire and failed to stimulate my students or me. So I sent an email at the end of the class asking all the students to come and visit me early in the next semester individually, just to see what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So and most of them showed up, and I put out the question, what was wrong with that class? Now, after the third student said that the class had been her favorite class, I said, how can that be?
Yeah.
I was bored. You were bored. You could feel the boredom in the room. She paused and she looked up, sort of looked at the books on my shelf as if to make a selection. She said, well, yeah, but all classes are sort of boring. Yours was less boring than most. And there was there was a moment, an aha moment,
yeah.
which went back to my days as an undergraduate at Harvard. That was exactly the way I felt.
Yeah.
Most of my classes were sort of boring. I did well enough to do well, but I skipped an awful lot of classes. I was never deeply engaged in the classroom experience. That was my experience as well. And the more I talked to colleagues, that was their experience. Well, and these are the students who went on to higher education.
Yeah.
These are the stars, so to speak. They were pretty much bored in the classroom experience. What about everybody else? So mm-hmm. that was the sort of thing that shook me to the core, mm-hmm. and it was an aha moment.
So what did you do then?
Well, I thought about that spring and summer about how to teach the class the next year. And so I decided I'd take the discussion of the big texts and turn them into debates. So for the first class, instead of having just a discussion of Plato's Republic, I would divide the class into different factions set in Athens of the time of Socrates, and then we do a trial of Socrates. And then we did that, and that went fine. I didn't imagine that anything I was doing was the least bit special, and it wasn't. Lots of people have done that sort of thing. And the second, we called them games. The second game was set in Ming China, and it was over the succession of a Ming emperor, and it turned on issues of Confucian interpretation of the Analects of Confucius. Mm-hmm. And the students did this debate, but it was all very lighthearted. The idea of students being Ming scholars advising the emperor, it all had a lighthearted feel. Yeah. I thought it was a debate, it was just fine. But the emperor and the first grand secretary, after one of these classes, came up to me and they were angry. They said, "This isn't how it would have been in Ming China." It wouldn't have been lighthearted and fun. It would have had a completely different feel. Uh-huh. And I said to them, "Well, you're right." And then I said, "Now Confucius believed that the reason you practice particular rituals, one reason, is it inculcates a certain behavior. So you defer." The reason you bow down to elders or emperors is because the act of prostrating yourself induces the feeling of humility. And you go through mourning rituals after someone's died because it also induces feeling of sadness and reverence. So maybe you should figure out some of the Ming rituals and use them. And one of the students said, "You mean you would let the students make them bow to Pervy?" And I said, "Sure." I didn't give any thought to it. Well, over the weekend, they went through Ming reference works and then prescribed a set of rituals that the students would have to sit up straight. They couldn't cross their legs. They couldn't make jokes. They couldn't have any side conversations. And then the students, the first grand secretary said, "And if you violate any of these, we will exile you, and you won't be able to speak, and your grade will suffer." Right. I had no idea that any of this was coming. and people looked at me. One student said, "She can't do that." And I said, "Well, sure she can." What happened is that as the students laid out the actual rituals, and then acted as if they were in place, that they really took charge of the room, and it became weird. Weird in the sense that the focus was ceased to be on me. It was now on the leaders of what was called the Hanlin Academy in Ming China. Mm-hmm. And they forgot about me and became immersed in the material. And at the end of the class, someone said, "Does anyone realize this class was supposed to end 7 minutes ago?" And everybody looked at the clock, and it was like that moment in a movie theater when the lights come on after a good movie, and you realized you've lost track of where you are. Huh. And that's what had happened in that class. And I thought, now, if in just one weekend of research, these students could create a different sort of world, what would happen if scholars would spend years developing elaborate games that would deeply recreate historical structures and problems and intellectual situations?
Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of
And that reacting. Became the basis for reacting. That the set piece debates evolved with the input of hundreds of scholars over the course of now 15 years to create these elaborate games set in the past where students take on roles.
So that was
informed
just,
by classic text.
That was just 15 years ago when you had that first class, that first aha moment.
Well, it took the first class was 20 years ago,
okay.
And the the articulation of the first sorts of games really was over 5 years. Then after 2001, other faculty began joining the enterprise in droves, and now there are eight or 900 people doing reacting, and probably a core group of 250 who are deeply immersed in the whole experience of designing games, of creating structures within the curriculum for these games. And these are faculty and administrators from some 350 colleges and universities.
So, okay. Your first work, one thing I'm just curious about, this might seem a little off topic, but your first work in, as a historian, was in 19th century sort of esoteric groups, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was interested in the... It's actually interesting. You point. I was interested in the Freemasons and Odd Fellows and Knights of Pythias and the Approved Order of Redmen. All of these organizations, which proliferated after the 1840s in the United States, especially, which had at their core ritualistic initiatory rituals. And the other thing about the rituals, they are all set in the past, and they're all often weird appropriations of historical peoples or savage, quote-quote, peoples,
savage, or different noble
peoples, the same middle-class people who were creating an urban industrial nation by day would spend much of their evenings pretending to be Knights of Malta or tribal peoples in Jerusalem or...
Inheritors of the
Indians,
wisdom of Solomon or whoever.
So that got me interested in the whole issue of using the past as an escape from using the past and rituals that evoke the power of the past to escape from an industrializing, urbanizing present, modernizing present.
It also gets us into, the idea that's so at the heart of Minds on Fire and of reacting, this idea of subversive play, competitive play, but also really subversive play.
Well, exactly right. And I think that these men who are doing these rituals were in many ways imaginatively subverting what they were doing by day. So I think that part of what appeals in the reacting games is that students can take on identities and behaviors and personas that are antithetical to who they are during the day.
Yeah. Your point is that you have a lovely point, which is a fantastic idea for someone who's willing to take this on, that the way that academics, way historians have typically written the history of higher education, wherever it might be, we talk about us, and we talk about the ideas, our conversations, what we've done, the curriculum we've developed, the institutions we've created. We rarely talk about students, or not to the extent that we should, and as part of that whole history. And the thing that you demonstrate is that there's been this sort of subversive shadow world of the university that goes on the entire time. Sometimes under the very noses of professors without their knowing it, and sometimes as a very open and explicit rebellion against the professors. Talk about that a little, if you would.
As an historian, I was puzzled by the deep roots of student disengagement. Why are students so disengaged? Is it really just that the class structures are so boring? And that doesn't make much sense, because the whole educational learning platform of higher education has indisputably improved over 200 years, but students, I think, are as disengaged now as they were in 1900 or 1870 or 1840. So,
if I might, one thing, I do want to push back a little bit at that. This is historically thinking, so let me try to do some. That's a very ahistoricist way of looking at it. Do you really think that it's always been this way, always, and there has been no alteration, change over time, in one way or the other? Have students always been this disengaged?
I think that certain pedagogical modes, the predominant pedagogical modes of the lecture especially, have never been very effective. Okay. Now, contemporary learning research, that's to say learning research that goes back 40 years, has made this point, and it's pretty much incontrovertible, that you don't learn very much from lectures, and lectures have, for millennia, perhaps, been the predominant pedagogical mode, the way that people with knowledge convey it to those who don't have it.
That was back when we didn't have paper, but we continue to do that. It was a technological mechanism to get around a technological deficit, but we have stubbornly persisted.
But we've gotten much better. The course designs now are much better than they were 50 or 100 years ago. Faculty are trained much better than they were 50 or 100 years ago. The whole experience in the classroom has improved, and I don't think that anyone who's looked at the issue finds that and would dispute that in the least. Hmm. But if that's the case, if the teaching experience has gotten better and students remain deeply disengaged, to wit, graduation rates, for example, is just one indicator, which haven't improved in 40 years. Why has this improving learning platform failed to grab students and bring them into the enterprise more deeply? And I think the reason is fairly constant, that always there has been this, you called it a shadow world, and that's a good phrase, but for students it is the world.
Yeah.
This world that the students have made in the 1840s, it was of the literary and debating societies, and where students would meet in taverns and put on theatrical productions and literary debates and choral competitions. And colleges tried to crush them.
Mm-hmm.
Then come fraternities in the 1860s and 1870s. Then comes students invent the football craze. Mm-hmm. Colleges and universities again try to crush these, get rid of them. They realize that students are putting all of their energies and intention into these activities. But in trying to get rid of them, the students threaten to leave en masse or go elsewhere.
It's a history of failure in trying to crush these things. It's
exactly right. Exactly right. And we can go to, obviously, the century-old battle against fraternities and sororities is an obvious example of it.
Yeah.
We could go to drinking.
Yeah. Binge drinking.
Which has gotten far worse than parents nowadays imagine. They say, "Oh, we drank a lot when we were college students." It's binge drinking now is an entirely different character from what it was 40 years ago.
It's a very serious problem.
Hugely serious in many ways. And of course, now we have the subversive worlds of video games, where people take on roles that are appallingly violent and misogynistic and contrary to everything we advocate in higher education. So it's exactly as you say. It's this shadow world that students get involved in. It involves competition, competition to get into fraternities, hazing competitions, leveling competitions in video games. It involves taking on new roles, becoming a brother in a new family of the fraternity, or taking on some role as in World of Warcraft, or as a car thief in Grand Theft Auto, or whatever. Yeah. You're taking on this new subversive role. You're doing things that are antithetical to what are the proper values, and it's great fun.
And students end up
putting their energies and their time into those activities rather than to those associated with their dullish classroom experience.
And they put a great deal of energy and time. I've been thinking about this. We just got done with pledging at Augustana College just a couple weeks ago. And I'm not sure how many professors realize, in fact, I know they don't. It was an older professor pointed this out to me who's been here for 15 years. How many students are tired because they've been so deeply involved in Greek life they are worn out in classroom. They're asleep because they've been committing so much of their time and energy to this. And it's also due to video games. I have lots of students fall asleep. I kind of chaff them about that after class is over, and they say, oh yeah, I was up late playing, you know, World of Warcraft or something like that. Not exactly an excuse, but an explanation, enough to tell me, anyone who's perceptive, that you're exactly right. They're spending a great deal of time and energy in these other activities, which are more important to them and real to them than what happens in the classroom.
Exactly right.
And we could, of course, just flunk them. But you prefer to, as it were, use these other habits for good.
What I think is that our play modes, the fraternities and video games that utilize these elements of competition and taking on new identities and living in worlds that have values that are very different from our own and therefore are somehow illicit, that this is, in a way, a definition of what fun is, taking you out of who you are, mm-hmm. what you believe, and inhabiting imaginatively very different worlds.
And that's critical thinking.
Well, absolutely right.
Yeah.
And what I think is that we could create genres of fun that are academically rich, and that's what reacting is. It is competitive. The students play games. These are not video games or digital games. These are games within the classroom. They're taking on new roles, perhaps as a oligarch in ancient Athens, perhaps as a Ming scholar, perhaps as a Franklin during the Constitutional Convention, perhaps as Gregoire during the French Revolution, perhaps all these different personas in different games. The game will then, the structure of the game and the rules will then draw them into those worlds. They do well in these worlds by mastering the rules, which is to say by mastering the historical context and by mastering the ideas, which is to say the texts, Plato's Republic in ancient Athens, Rousseau's Social Contract in revolutionary France, Muhammad Iqbal's poetry in India in the 1930s and 40s. The structure of the game draws students into big ideas and big texts in important historical contexts, and they lose themselves in these worlds. I recount stories in my book about students who couldn't keep up with their video games or their digital online games because they had to concentrate on the French Revolution to do well in that game. Students who wouldn't go to their sorority mixers because they wanted to do well in their reacting game because it was more fun. I interviewed this one student, and I said, well, you know, I don't imagine mixers are really all that much fun anyway. And she said, oh, no, they are really fun, but doing badly in reacting, not knowing your stuff, giving a poor speech, that's devastating, whereas doing well is exhilarating, and it's more fun than a mixer.
We're going to have to close there. We're just about out of time. My guest today has been Mark C. Carnes, professor of history at Columbia University and the creator, the godfather of reacting to the past, which is, we're going to be talking about this again on Historically Thinking. I have a number of other historians who have used reacting, and we'll discuss how it worked for us and some of the other ideas that Mark discusses in his book, Minds on Fire. And we'll also be discussing in a future podcast history and gamification, which is a terrible word, which a lot of game designers dislike, but is in many ways, it seems to me, the direction of the 21st century for education and many other things. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed this.
For more Historical Thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG Studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.